you these days represent the Deep Sea Conservation Coalition for, is it for the Oceania?
Yeah, I guess area? I'm the Pacific Regional Lead on the deep sea mining side of what we do. Yeah.
And last time I talked to you, I think you were in Egypt, were you?
Yeah, that'd be right. Yeah.
Yeah, or Portugal.
Both. Could have been either.
I think you went to I think you were in Portugal, and then you put something on Facebook that I played after you'd got out of a meeting in Egypt.
Yeah, I came back from Europe via the COP27 climate conference in Egypt, which was an eye-opener. Yeah,
I bet. Mm. Generally, at that time, you were saying there was a growing, seemed to be quite successful growth in the opposition to deep sea mining, seabed mining. Has that continued?
It has continued, yeah. So what we're talking about is this area in the middle of the Pacific. Sort of, if you sort of zoom out on the globe and spin it to looking between Hawaii and Mexico, so you've got Hawaii on the left and Mexico on the right, there's an area that's as wide as the United States.
And there's not really any islands there or anything?
No, it's an area that they call there's an abyssal plain there, so it's 4,000 to 6,000 meters deep, and it's as wide as the United States. And there's exploration permits that spread right across that.
So there's no one there to protect it or even see what's going on except some fish and a pile of garbage.
So but it's international waters, so it's not any one country's space.
And
the resources that exist there have been deemed by international law as the common heritage of humankind. So,
and we got to mine it.
Every one of us have a stake in it, and it's only supposed to be used if it benefits all of humanity. And
there's something about the seabed mining. Like, you know, I've been interviewing you about this for like 10 years now, I think, and something that seems to be a trend in it is that it's out of sight, out of mind, and that sounds like there is nowhere more out of sight than this part of the world, maybe Antarctica. But
well, there's a link to Antarctica as well, which I can talk about. But yes, it is. It's absolutely out of anyone's idea of what exists down there. You know, it's the most poorly understood part of the planet. And it's the most difficult to access as well.
Well, that was my first thought when you said it was like 4 to 6 kilometers to the seabed. That environment to work it, try and do anything in is extraordinarily difficult. And what do they want to mine?
So they want to mine is these vast areas of seafloor that's relatively flat, and there's rocks. They call them polymetallic nodules, like nodules or rocks that contain several metals in them. They basically want to hoover those up and hoover all the sediment up, well, the sediment that they lie in, and pull the rocks out, and then pump, similar to what they were proposing in Taranaki here, pump all the waste material back into the water column and just push it out into the environment for the environment to deal with all the waste. But the rocks themselves provide the habitat for the organisms that exist there. So if you remove those rocks, you're basically destroying habitat on a permanent sort of basis, because those rocks take millions of years to form.
Right.
And then the sediment that the rocks are sort of set in, they'll suck up the top 5 to 10 centimetres of sediment as they're hoovering up the rocks.
Yeah.
That sediment is full of life, and that's, you know, it's a sort of foundational aspect to the whole food chain, food web within the ocean. And the other thing is that every time, you know, talking to scientists, every time they go out and start taking samples, they're pulling up things they've never knew existed before.
Of course, because it's so far down and we've never been there.
And it's not. And one was a Spanish woman was telling me that, you know, it's not like there's some animals here and some organisms that exist in this area, and then 20 k's that way there's some different ones. It's more like 70 meters that way, and there's a whole different array of organisms that exist there. So they're saying it's possibly the most diverse area on the planet. Diverse meaning difference of, you know, organisms spread in different
and
areas.
And is the industry trying to give the impression that there's nothing down there at all? Like we heard about someone from TTR, Trans-Tasman Resources, referring to the seabed out here as a desert.
Absolutely.
So that's the PR or the propaganda on it.
That's the PR. and they're saying, you know, we can do this with far less damage to the than you can on land. But that's a false statement because they don't even know what exists down there, so they don't know what they're breaking.
And that's another theme that's run through this all the time, is they don't really know. They certainly can't prove what the effects are going to be.
Exactly.
And it's that unknown factor that's been the reason that the EPA has not granted them anything.
That's right. And in the Trans-Tasman Resources application that we all stood up and fought against for many years, even there at 20 metres depth, just 20 kilometres from shore, they couldn't describe the marine environment. They couldn't describe what existed there, what function it performed, how it related to the rest of the area of the South Taranaki Bight, and what the impacts would be. So this international space, it's thousands of kilometres from shore and thousands of metres deep. So it's a long, long way. The best estimate for filling the scientific gaps is 20 to 30 years.
Okay.
As far as research needed before they can actually make decisions with a reasonable amount of certainty about what the impacts might be.
So what's the impact, the kind of chain of events? Like if you mess up the seafloor, people might say, well, it's a long way down and that's, yes, we're destroying a lot of diversity, but how does that affect us? So what's the kind of
look at it from a climate perspective, the deep ocean, the seabed in the deep ocean, or the seabed of the ocean, is the biggest carbon sink in the world, right? So start disturbing that, and then there are processes which we don't understand. In Egypt, a scientist from California was talking about the discovering they've observed a process which they haven't quite understood. There's a certain amount of carbon coming in through the surface of the ocean, but then there's more being stored in the sea floor, so they haven't quite figured it out. So they're finding that there are systems and functions that they don't understand.
Well, this is what I want, because I hear the word carbon sink, and it sounds like, oh, you just chuck it in and we're all good. But I know from on land that there's natural processes that the carbon has to go through to end up being sequestered in the soil. So I presume it's not a matter of just throwing it in there.
Yeah.
And so you're destroying the environment that does that work.
You're screwing with the machine.
Yeah.
The most powerful machine that we have, the ocean, right? And we're ocean people in this community, and we understand that the state of the ocean is in a sort of a dire condition, right? And we need to be moving to improve ocean health rather than starting new activities that deplete ocean health.
Yeah. So from the other side of things, we know there's a lot of people in the world and there's a lot of pressure on resources. And I know that one of the reasons they're looking at deep sea stuff is because, you know, so much stuff has been mined elsewhere. That pressure's not going to go away. I guess the only way to make that go away is to find alternative means of producing the things that they would have produced from there. Is there anything to say in that area?
Yeah, I mean, the battery, so the company that's, there's one company that's really pushing for this. They used to be called Deep Green. They're now called the Metals Company.
They took the word deep out of the title.
Well, Deep Green, anyway. They're talking about they can source metals for a billion EVs, from a mine or something like that. But the EV batteries that are in evolution are removing cobalt and removing nickel. So the biggest sort of battery producer is in China, and they've pulled cobalt and nickel out of their battery manufacturing process. So the battery technology is moving really fast. There's things like batteries coming out that are based primarily on graphite and iron phosphate. So there's battery technology moving really quick, and we don't really need the metals to the extent that they're portraying.
Is China a little bit ahead of the West in this area?
China has a bit of a stronghold on metals supply globally, they have licenses in this area that I'm describing in the Pacific. They have two licenses there, I think.
Oh, so they're doing it both sides then?
Yeah, but they're also not rushing. So the problem is at the moment is that a trigger was pushed in international law that says, it was in 2021, that says we want to start mining in 2 years, finish the rules and regulations so we can make an application and we can start.
Right.
That was done in June 2021 and it expires July this year. So there's a real rush. And actually what happened was all the countries went, hold on, we're not ready for this. So they kind of poked the bear, you know.
Yeah,
And everyone's woken up and now there's this move to stop it and pause it. And China's not really in a rush. You know, they're approaching it with in a responsible way, I think.
There's so much propaganda around US versus China these days. It's hard to talk about them with any sort
certainty.
Of common sense.
Yeah.
But they don't. I know they're not affected by the corporate sector. The corporate sector doesn't have a hold on their government like they do in the US. And the corporate sector, we know, I'm sure we've all talked about many times, they're always looking at their next quarter. That's their horizon, you know.
Yeah.
So, short-term thinking abounds.
Yeah, I mean, in the corporate sector, in this case, WWF has sort of had a campaign running on trying to get companies to support a moratorium. We're calling for a moratorium, a pause, stop the process of advancing towards starting mining.
Yeah.
And, you know, a bunch of big companies, Google, Samsung, Volvo, BMW, Volkswagen have all stood up to support a moratorium and say they won't take these deep sea metals or materials into their supply chains.
So you were saying when I spoke to you a few months ago that a lot of countries are coming on board with the opposition. That's what you were seeing in the meetings that you were at.
Yes.
And so have there been more? Is there more of them coming on board?
Yeah. So there's currently 12 countries that are standing for either a moratorium, or some are using the term precautionary pause. It's exactly the same as a moratorium.
Yeah.
And France has stood up and said a ban. They've called for an outright ban.
Wow.
So there's France, Germany, Spain out of Europe, in the Pacific. It's Palau, Federated States of Micronesia, Samoa, and New Zealand and Fiji, and then there's a few Latin American countries as well.
So we have as well.
We have. So
thought you were going to say we hadn't, to
no,
be honest.
No, we worked with Minister Nanaia Mahuta for about a year and a half.
Having conversations with her?
With a team of us, in the first meeting we had with her, she was like, okay, we need to do something about this. She really caught it really early in it, but it took a year for the policy to come through.
It's probably
process.
Quite fast for politics, isn't
maybe.
It?
Maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. It was a learning curve to observe how it went.
Yeah. You've got to have the staying power. Mm. So the New Zealand context, we keep getting applications and then the last one, they would get turned down. The last one ended up in court. Is it still in court?
It's
been good news for.
Yeah, there's been a few rounds of good news. We lost in 2017 and when the EPA gave TTR the license, and then that was overturned in the High Court. So we won in the High Court. We won in the next round of Court of Appeals, and then we also won at the Supreme Court level. And so the Supreme Court said, "Give it back to the EPA and rethink it, and have it go through the process again." Use this framework now, basically you can't allow anything that's going to cause material harm was the term they used.
Yeah.
And, there were issues around tikanga, honouring tikanga and implementing those rules as part of the decision making as well. Yeah, it's at back with the EPA and we're waiting for a call from the EPA to say, okay, the process is beginning when, and we don't know. I think it'll start in the first half of this year, and we'll see how we go.
So how is it still going?
I don't know how these things work really, but it's going back around. My sense is that it's really there's no way that they can gain consent. TTR themselves, the company, has sold to an Australian to an Australian mining company, so I think they've given up hope a little bit, and so they should, because there's no way they can gain consent.
If I was an investor, I would still steer well clear.
Sure. No one...
Because the uncertainty around it is the thing that's holding it back, and no one's solved that.
Yeah. Very few... Only people who have played the market have ever made money on, on seabed mining anywhere in the world. You know, it's only people who have gone in at the right time and pulled out at the right time, because there's never been a seabed mining operation kicked off. Nobody's actually sucked.
So, and I imagine those speculators might be aware of that, or maybe they're just good at playing the ups and downs.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, okay. Oh, well, all right. So where are you off to next?
On Monday, I'm off to Panama to a conference. It's Our Ocean, it's called. It's a two-day conference. We're working with the governments of Panama, Palau, and France to put on an event about this, because basically pulling all those countries back together and inviting others in to, you know, stand up and say we support this as well. And so we're putting on an event there, and then I'll visit my folks in California for a week or so, and then going to Kingston, Jamaica, back to the International Seabed Authority meeting, which is the second half of March.
Do you speak at these meetings?
In the Our Ocean one, I might be asked to say something. In Kingston, not so much. I just go and speak to other humans. And
there's a lot of stuff at these meetings that goes on behind the scenes, isn't there?
A lot of it, yeah. It's a lot about having conversations around the kava bowl, or, you know, just in the halls. And, you know, for me, I've been engaging with this for a long time, so I understand it pretty well.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, it's quite fresh, you know, they haven't tuned into it, so I'm able to inform people on you know, the problems with it and where it's at the moment and so on. So I think it's kind of useful to help decision makers.
Yeah, there is a lack of information for people out there. I mean, we in Raglan, we don't lack for information. We know about this fight and we understand it, but most communities are not where we are with that.
Yeah. I think the other heartening thing is that, you know, when we all heard about this back in 2005, and, you know, there was a big push through that second half of that decade, and then through the last decade where, you know, there was a lot going on, our first response, at least mine was, and I think this was the same for a lot of people, is, what the hell are you talking about? That's crazy. That's what are you doing? You can't come in and do that. That's just going to break stuff. And what we've found is that the science has caught up with our intuitive response. You know, the science is saying, you know, you guys are right. You know, that will break that will make that go extinct. You know, it shouldn't happen.
The simplest thing for me was if you tried to do that on, like, the Canterbury Plains, and everyone could see what was happening, there'd be complete uproar.
And then just pour all the waste out of pipe for the river to deal with without treating it or anything.
Yeah, we've seen we've seen the results of that lately, haven't we?
Yeah.
In different industries.
Yeah. So, and then the other heartening thing as well is that there's an example in Antarctica. So when on the day that Nanaia Mahuta made the announcement of New Zealand's position for a conditional moratorium, Jacinda was in Antarctica enjoying, you know, the wonderful space that was protected 30 or 40 years ago.
Yeah.
At that 30, 40 years ago, there was a point where they were about to enable and start mining for oil, gas, and minerals and metals.
Right.
But Bob Hawke from Australia stood up and said, I don't think this is a good idea. Maybe we should not do this, and maybe we could make it a place for peace and science and understanding and all that, you know. France jumped on board. They rallied the rest of the world over the next two or three years, and now in Antarctica was protected and for at least 50 years, and there's a whole bunch of hoops that have to be jumped through before they can open it up again. So imagine what Antarctica would be like today had they not made that decision 30 years ago.
And
this space in international waters, again, it's similar to Antarctica. No one country owns it.
Yeah.
So there's a in Egypt, the Spanish Prime Minister stood up and said, "And we do not forget Antarctica."
That's good, because we too tend to forget things like that.
Yeah.
We do, yeah. Hey, folks, we've been talking to Phil McCabe, Deep Sea Conservation Coalition. Phil, does the organisation need support at all, just before we go?
Just tune into it on social media and do it, you know, Deep Sea Conservation Coalition. Tune in, share the information, read the information.
Okay.
Financially, we're fine.
Okay, yep. Well, that's nice to hear.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a bit of a change.
All right, man. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Aaron. Cheers.
All right, folks, we've got Dan Bull waiting for the next interview of the morning, and we're going to be talking AI in just a few minutes.